But the essence of Web 2.0 is literally building systems that get better the more people use them.
The Economist.
From Berkeley, this is The Economist. Today I'm speaking with Tim O'Reilly, book publisher, conference organizer, and thinker of Silicon Valley. I started by asking Tim to think back to 2003 when the Valley was coming out of a deep recession and he coined a new phrase, Web 2.0.
Pretty clearly, it was grim times after the dot-com bust. And in 2003 at O'Reilly, we actually set an explicit goal of trying to restart enthusiasm in the computer industry. And although it wasn't until 2004 that we actually launched the conference that gave the era its name, Web 2.0. Everybody thought the web was dead, but in fact, it was due for a turnaround. In the first generation, we had the whole idea of stickiness on websites, and now we have syndication. In the initial phase, we had this whole idea that everybody would come to your site, and now it's spread out throughout the web. We had the idea that it was DoubleClick for advertising, and now it's Google AdSense.
I remember I was there at that first Web 2.0 conference. What do you remember of the buzz and the excitement after this long nuclear winter of the bust years?
People were realizing that, in fact, there was a renaissance, and clearly it was headlined by Google. Google had effectively sat out the dot-com bust, still a private company, and they were on everybody's mind as a big money maker.
Everyone's jaws dropped. I remember when Google finally revealed how much money it was making. I think nobody was really ready that advertising was such a good business model. Do you remember the
Oh, absolutely. But it wasn't just that it was advertising. It was a very different kind of advertising. You know, the core lesson is that users add value. You know, that this wasn't just something that applied to software development via open source software was something that applied to every successful site on the internet. You realized, oh, Google, first of all, they're mining all the pages on the net. We are their raw material. Secondly, their breakthrough in search engine accuracy was through realizing that we were all contributing this additional value in the form of the links that we made. So they're harvesting that value and using it to get better search results. And then their third innovation was to actually create a real-time ad auction, which is where they made all the money. Literally, advertisers were chosen based on whether or not users actually clicked on their ads.
Let's take this idea that you later turned into the core definition of Web 2.0, which is that it's about applications on the web that get better the more people use it. I've always thought that was the most portable, for me, part of your definition that you then gave to Web 2.0, but maybe you can think back to when you felt the need to give a definition at all, because it was getting quite slippery and there was a lot of hype,
well, I think,
right?
So a lot of what happened pretty early on was that there were a whole lot of new startups that started to wrap themselves in the mantle of Web 2.0. And for many people, what the term came to mean was sort of a lightweight, cheap startup that was using advertising, often in the form of Google AdWords, as its business model. And I felt the need to say, no, that's missing the point. There are many, many startups that might be lightweight and use advertising, but the essence of Web 2.0 is literally building systems that get better the more people use them. What's important is that they understand that once you're on the network, you can do something collectively that before you were doing individually.
And yeah, so maybe we can name a couple of examples.
Flickr, the photo sharing service that was later bought by Yahoo, realized that you could simply make photos public by default. And they just blew past all the first-generation photo sharing services. They realized that on the network, you'd be way more viral. You'd grow much faster if you were open to anybody viewing the photos.
Yes. And I think it's really interesting the way you just essentially said that what was of primary importance to you was the fact that this is about apps that get better as more people use them, not the advertising part. But then there was this succession of genuine next big things, MySpace, YouTube, Flickr, Facebook, Twitter, and it just so happened that they all did not have a business model except when pressed, they would usually say something mumbling about advertising. So in effect, they played into that. And that's when we maybe got into a little bit of trouble, right? That we only have one next big thing, namely Google, which actually had a happened to have a genuine advertising innovation to go with the other one.
Well, yes and no. A lot of my thinking about all this was very much shaped by the history of the personal computer industry. In 1981, IBM was the equivalent of Microsoft, monopolistic, proprietary. And then they did something that had unexpected consequences, and that is they released the design of a personal computer using standard off-the-shelf parts with a published specification, such that virtually anybody could make a PC. And what the profound change was that hardware became a commodity. Because they didn't understand the consequences, they made a deal with a little company called Microsoft to provide the software for this new, you know, platform. So they basically knocked out their own underpinnings, and then they gave the keys of the kingdom to someone else. The same thing was happening with open source software. That is, it was becoming commoditized. That we were starting to see, you know, low or no cost commodity software displacing proprietary software.
And this led you to your famous thing that I loved, which is so memorable, that data, not the software, but the data is the new Intel inside.
That's exactly my point. But in particular, data that's accumulated through user participation and network effects becomes the locus of competitive advantage. You know, you can kind of see it with any of the Web 2.0 success stories. You know, eBay, it was the accumulation of a critical mass of a network of buyers and sellers. You know, whether the business model is e-commerce or advertising or something else, you know, the accumulation of user contribution and the harnessing of user contribution and what I ultimately came to call harnessing collective intelligence is in fact, you know, the core of the story. This is why, you know, Microsoft's software plus service mantra, I think, misses the boat. You literally have to have a situation in which it's better to be part of the crowd.
Let's try to figure out what seems to me to be, at least on the face of it, an interesting paradox, that some of the businesses that a lot of people associate most with the Web 2.0 era, so for instance, YouTube and Facebook, have such trouble adding economic value to themselves to that.
I think it's still too early to tell. Again, I just roll back the clock to, you know, say the 80s, when there were hundreds, if not thousands, of personal computer software companies. Most of them failed, you know, and would you say that there was something wrong, there was a paradox in the software business model that most software companies were not able to actually become successful? The fact is that in a network effects world, you tend to have winner-takes-all marketplaces.
But does that suggest that some of these next big things that we live our lives on are successes in the way that Hotmail was a success? Just we all now understand that webmail was the obvious next step.
I think all of these things are subsystems of this, you know, this future platform that we are building. And I think that it's not at all clear that all of them will be directly monetizable. Does that mean that we don't need them? Absolutely not. I think there are definitely more successes to come. Some of them will be flash in the pan. They will get incorporated into the operating system. But again, this is nothing new. You know, there are many companies that had a stab at a business model until Microsoft offered the same feature for nothing as part of the operating system. You know, Netscape, you know, probably one of the most visible among them, you know, where the browser just got integrated, and
yes,
that was the end of the browser as an independent possible business model. Do I think that we will ultimately figure out how to monetize YouTube and Facebook and Twitter? Absolutely.
If they do turn out to be features of the operating system to be inside of, let's say, Google, that really means we're only beginning to understand the incredible power of Google from today forward.
Yeah, frankly, you know, when I've been trying to get people to think about what's next, the last couple of years, what I've really been emphasizing is the idea that we're moving out of the world in which the web is driven by, you know, humans typing on keyboards, and increasingly into a world in which the data that's generated into these collective intelligence applications is driven by sensors. The downside is you can say then, well, the web is everything. You know, so for example, when your car talks to the toll booth, in some sense, that's a Web 2.0 application. Because of course your car is talking today to the toll booth, but who else is it talking to tomorrow and next year? Maybe it's talking to your insurance company as well. You know, we're starting to figure out that all of the people, all of the things have these huge data shadows, which are starting to intermingle. And there are so many different ways to use that data in helping people to understand, you know, new marketplaces. In a really good marketplace, a player creates more value than they capture.
Right.
Twitter is, you know, I know it's going to be okay because they are creating value for, you know, Twitter is now a major referrer to other people's sites and services. So they'll eventually be able to monetize that.
Maybe just lastly, you've mentioned a couple of times these data shadows. That's a really great metaphor. I'm already picturing the reader letters that play with the metaphor and predict a world of shadows. Is there anything about these permanent, ever-present databases that are interconnecting about us that makes you nervous, or is there nothing at all?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's no future without downsides. There are trade-offs in everything, and the ones that are the worst are the ones that we don't understand or anticipate. Overall, the risk to us of hiding from the digital future is greater than the risk of embracing it. You know, we have got to actually, for example, find how to use some of these Web 2.0 tools in better government. How can we apply the tools of mass collaboration that we've seen on the consumer internet to some of the goals that have been put forward by President Obama in the area of transparency, accountability of government? We're spending, you know, trillions of dollars. How do we watch that? There are techniques that have been developed on the consumer internet for dealing with information at scale that could be very, very helpful. How do we build a smarter electrical grid that actually uses these same principles that are really the laws of networks so that the grid is actually better and smarter by being connected? How can we use, you know, the techniques that Google uses for search results to actually improve our detection of infectious diseases? All of these are huge opportunities where we could make a difference.
That was Tim O'Reilly, a thinker of Silicon Valley and coiner of the phrase Web 2.0. As you heard, Silicon Valley remains as optimistic as ever and as aggressively futuristic as ever. From Berkeley, this is The Economist.
The Economist.